The Wellstone, a novel by Will McCarthy. Recording copyright 2002 by Will McCarthy. This novel, read to you by the MAPI for One Speech Synthesizer, may be distributed freely. The Wellstone, ISBN 0553584464, was published by Bantam Books in 2003, and is available in paperback form wherever fine books are sold. Chapter 3. Domes of the popcorn moon, they bounced through a repeater just inside the orbit of Pluto, and were funneled into a ring collapsitor segment, a conduit made of tiny black holes where their signal could travel, for a while, much faster than the classical speed of light. Planets and planets and planetoids whizzed by, and seemed, there was no sensation associated with this. The boys' bodies and minds, perhaps their souls, were reduced to quantum wave packets for the journey. This was the NESCLG, the new system-wide collapsitor grid, brainchild of Bascal's father. To an outside observer, the journey from Camp Friendly in the middle Kuiper belt to Earth in the inner system could appear to take anywhere from 8 to 10 hours, depending on network congestion and the alignment of the various nodes and conduits. To the boys themselves, the journey felt and for practical purposes was instantaneous. No more significant or amazing than stepping through a curtain. They could have specified a number of copies and spilled out the other end en masse, an army of themselves. They could have specified a color and come out with skin of bright blue or brighter pink. They could have specified an orientation and come out facing backwards. But they did none of these things and stepped out as themselves. Nothing else had occurred to them on the spur of the moment. And anyway, mix like that would only trip the filters and provoke inquiry. On the curtain's other side was Athens, where it was noon and brutally hot. Another single step whisked them around to Calcutta, which was also hot and drenched in monsoon rains. They ended up in Denver, where the sun had recently set on a summer warm city, and the air was fresh and fine. They spilled out into Market Street Station, jabbering, punching one another, giggling. Freedom was theirs at last, and the news of their escape could not have traveled any faster than the boys themselves. It would be a while before anyone came looking. "I have no guards," the prince said wonderingly. He turned and crushed Conrad in a hug, then did the same to a cringing Hoed. "I have no guards," he whirled, laughing, oblivious to the staring crowd. A billboard of animated Wellstone proudly announced this station as one of only 5 public fax depots in the downtown area. A little map showed their locations, scattered along a kidney-shaped district a couple of kilometers across, and the flanking text informed the boys that ownership and operation of private fax gates within the exclusion zone was sharply restricted. Depending on the boys' exact destination, their transportation options from here included bus, free, automotive taxi, dollars, horse-drawn, hansom, cab, dollars, and of course walking, which according to the sign was strongly encouraged in a commercial preservation zone of Denver's caliber. "Ooh," one of the boys said, pretending to be impressed, and emphasizing the remark with the raised, limp hands of some supposed to feed aristocracy. It was Umbed Fikra who did this, with an additional layer of irony he probably wasn't aware of. By the standards of Camp Friendly, he was an effete aristocrat, the hyperactive child of 2 well-known television critics. "Feck the fairy, shut up," Bascal told him mildly. "Denver's raw, it's good, you should be happy." Conrad hadn't seen the place except on TV, but overall he was inclined to agree. Back in his parents' day, fax technology had hit urban areas like a saturation bombing campaign, rewriting their maps and landscapes overnight. Many cities became beehives of addressable spaces whose physical locations were all but irrelevant. Streets vanished. Sidewalks vanished. Neighborhoods vanished. In some cases the cities themselves vanished, or became hypothetical entities with outposts scattered all over the solar system. But Denver's urban planners had seen it coming, and had drawn this cordon around the heart of the city to preserve it from the tyrannies of convenience. Not just a children's city, but an urban preservation district and member of the Living Museum Network. A place as classic and primal as the Fuck You song, and twice as pretty. The terminal itself was underground, a dimly lit urban space filled with columns and information kiosks and snack bars, and old-fashioned telephones that were probably just for show. Another billboard fizzed, illuminated for some reason with tiny red dots, announced periods of planned outage in the fax gates here, and periods of broadband connection to some specific destination for some specific window of time. HONOLULU21-1521-170DAY. There were ranks of embossed numbers along the ceiling, although what purpose they served was not apparent. Some people carried luggage and eccentricity in a world where fax machines could store any object in callable library routines and print copies on demand. There were other eccentricities apparent in the crowd. People who looked older or younger than the ageless standard of queendom beauty. People who were dressed funny. People who had funny hair. And children of various ages. Of course, comprising nearly 10% of this crowd of dozens, the mix was interesting and cosmopolitan and, yeah, highly raw, fresh, original, whatever. but everyone in the crowd, even the children, seemed to greet the arrival of 14 unescorted, dirty-faced adolescents as a sign of trouble. A mother snatched up the hand of her toddler and pulled him close. Others were less overt, but their suspicion was lightly veiled at best. Welcome to Denver. Keep your hands where we can see them. Conrad gave back some dirty looks, and even snapped his teeth at a woman he caught staring at him. Gods, it wasn't like people got away with crimes anymore. Not when the whole earth was one giant censor. Even where events weren't explicitly recorded in a well-stone matrix, they left, like quantum traces in the rocks or something, ghosts, with enough patience and computing power. Almost any event could be reconstructed. Ignoring the ill will around them, Pascal surveyed the chamber itself, and grinned. I think we've arrived, men. There was an escalator leading up to street level, and Hoa and Steve Grush, with hardly a glance at Pascal or any of the others, hopped onto it and went up. The prince, perhaps sensing a threat to his leadership, hopped onto the down escalator and called out, "Onward, onward!" It wasn't hard to run up against the descending staircase. Although what effort it took was strangely infuriating, the laws of gravity doubly stacked against you. And the people riding down were of course not amused as the boy swarmed past, but nobody said anything or tripped anyone. So Pascal made it to the top only a few moments behind Ho and Steve. And right there beside him was Conrad, the right-hand man, feeling important. Oh, he'd felt important a time or two already this summer, going to the same camp as the Prince of Soul, but this was different. This was non-accidental. The two of them were actual friends. This is Ra, he said to Pascal in a low, private tone, and the prince responded with a defiant fist, held where only Conrad could see it. Until somebody recognizes their Pylenisi, me boy. Then it gets complicated, mmm. Conrad could only nod knowingly. Pylenisi was the Tongan word for prince, and he knew or imagined he knew what that meant for Basquel's life. No shortage of women, for one thing, but no privacy either. Everyone figured they knew him, when in fact almost nobody really did. But then, this disheveled boy in camp shirt and boating culottes didn't much resemble the Pascal Edward you saw on TV. Up at ground level, circular doorways irised open for them in the terminal building's glass outer wall. The air outside was perfect. Summer warm and sunset cool, not a bit muddy. It smelled of food. Garlic and fresh baked bread, maybe kale corn hopping somewhere nearby. The sidewalks were concrete with inlays of what looked like real stone, you could tell by the rough texture of it. Not at all like a well-stone emulation. So here they were. 160H and Market in the Mile High City, an almost mythical address. The center of Ra. To the east a few blocks was self-similar street, where they were still recording the puppet show live every week. Somewhere to the south was the Cola Dome where the Broncos and Avalanche and Nuggets still played. Where famous concerts were held. And paintball battles waged. On the streets, as advertised, was actual vehicular traffic. White buses and yellow/black taxis, delivery trucks and horse-drawn carriages. Rather a lot of bicycles. Two. Piloted not by children but by serious-looking adults swathed in impact-resistant well-cloth. There were also a few pedicabs drawn by midgets, which struck Conrad as an odd touch indeed. Where did you find midgets in an age of perfect health? The sidewalks were crowded and vibrant, full of obstacles for the pedestrians to flow around in artful patterns. This was a city of posts and pedestals, columns and obelisks, a fountain burbled merrily. There were little trees everywhere, maples and poplars and even acacias, no more than 4 or 5 meters tall. But the towers looming all around, blocking the view of all behind them, were anything but miniature. It was only when Pascal led them around a corner onto a 168th Street that anything resembling mountains became visible, hulking dimly ahead in the sunset, shrouded by clouds, crowded from beneath by low buildings. But the mountains were shorter than Conrad would've expected, or else farther away. In the golden red glow of the clouds it was hard to tell, but that was the direction Pascal led them. Away from the towers, toward the sunset, the boys made a rough passage through the city. Hooting, snatching at leaves, kicking and leaping over benches, crowding people out of their way. There was no law against being surly, and oh boy did it feel good. Still, Conrad couldn't quite keep his eyes off the architecture. It was one of the few things he was good at and cared about. The history of building, and of the buildings themselves. Here, that history was written in the walls, layered like geological strata. Look at the sidewalk, he said to Pascal. And when that was ignored, he tried, look at that wall. Is it brick? It looks like brick. Whatever, Pascal replied, not mocking but barely looking, either. The question didn't interest him. Conrad tried it on Ubed Fikra. You study architecture, Feck. Feck raised his limp, sarcastic hands again. Ooh, architecture. Okay, so maybe it wasn't a popular subject. Still, it seemed important, especially here. There were exactly two subjects Conrad hadn't failed in his last school year. Architecture and matter programming. These he pursued with an intensity that upset his teachers nearly as much as his apathy and surliness on the other subjects. Only history had inspired any enthusiasm at all. And only because this time it had included the light wars, which of course were the first intersection of architecture and matter programming. If he hadn't spat in Mrs. Reglan's chair and then called Mr. Omarao Pigficker for catching him, he might have learned even more. But what he did know fascinated him. The moment Wellstone programmable matter had found its way into the old republics, the light wars had started. Without delay, without restraint, what anarchy. Buildings geoidally sucking in ambient energy, dumping waste heat, offending the eye with patterns of superreflector and superabsorber. With flashing lights. With blasts of communication laser unfettered by any cable or conduit. It was much cheaper to rustle energy out of the environment than to buy it off the grid. So all concern for aesthetics had flown right out the window. Overnight. Along with concern for the comfort of passers-by and even, to some extent, for their safety. You could have all the electricity you wanted. If you blackly drank in every photon that touched you, you could stay cool in the summertime. If your building was a perfect mirror focusing the heat back on its unfortunate neighbors. In fact, if you were clever and obnoxious enough you could do both at the same time. Deepening every shadow. Amplifying every pool of brightness for your own convenience. This wasn't as crippling a blow to city life as the fax wars 20 years later. But the scars remained even after the Queendom's founding, when the architectural courtesy edicts were rammed through. Here in Denver you could practically tell, just by looking, which decade each building had been constructed in. Here an ancient steel frame structure of poured concrete. Its Wellstone a mere facade. There a building of pure Wellstone, held up against gravity by the pressure of electrons in quantum dots. This had struck Conrad as a dumb idea the first moment he heard of it. What if the power failed? But truthfully he'd never heard of a case where one of these selfish buildings had collapsed or dissolved. There must be all sorts of safeguards. The majority of the buildings were post-Queendom. Diamond frames and floors, with Wellstone sheathing and facing. But even these had been dressed down, made to resemble materials of more or less natural origin. Denver, like most of the really great cities, had forcibly regressed itself to something resembling the end of the 21st century. A preponderance of stone and metal and silica glass. Lighted signs had to look a certain way. Like neon or mercury vapor or electroluminescent bulk diode. As the sunset deepened and the street lights came on one by one, he noted with satisfaction that they were simulated gas flame. Had there been gas lights in the 21st century? If not, there ought to have been. As the boys made their way westward, a full moon slipped into view from behind one of the towers. "Awoo!" said a kid named Peter Cold, pointing. Pascal turned, looked, spread his arms. "Ah, now that is a moon. July, to be specific. The buck moon. And we, my friends, are the young bucks making our way in the world. Let all the people of the domes of the moon gaze down upon us in wonder. This is our night, buck moon." "Says who?" someone asked. "Says the naval almanac," Pascal answered. Feck cleared his throat. "It's, from the Algonquin." Conrad turned. "North American Tribal Society. Very old, but, you know, still in existence. Almost as big as the islands of Tonga, actually, almost as many people." Now everyone was looking at Feck, and even by gaslight you could see him blushing. Pascal looked surprised. "Feck, you don't know things, do you?" "Peter knows things, he's the son of laureates. Conrad thinks he knows things, although he's a son of a bitch the last I heard. But you, wait a minute, I'm perceiving something. You have a connection to this tribe. Wait, don't tell me. You're, let's see." He studied Feck's complexion and features for a moment. "You're 1/8 by blood, 1/4, Feck said, "but it's not Algonquin, it's Chippewa. They're neighbors. For us, this is the raspberry moon. You're practically a native guide." "I had no idea. I've never been to North America," Feck said. "Anyway, this area is Kiowa, or maybe Lakota, the horse moon." "We'll have to horse around," Pascal answered merrily. "And give a big, fat raspberry to the good citizens of Denver." "Any other moons we should know about tonight?" Feck scratched his ear, uncomfortable with the attention. The crowds were lighter here. The boys were practically alone in their pool of lamplight. The corn moon, or maybe it's popcorn moon, also raptor, thunder, and blood. Wow. That's raw. I like it. We'll screech like eagles, leaving a wake of thunder and blood. And raspberry popcorn. Actually, that's quite silly. But anyway, the town is ours, and I say we take a bite. The poet prince. Conrad snorted to himself. Go and Steve, and impressed by this dialogue, exchanged a look, then turned and started off toward the sunset again. And once again, Pascal seemed honor-bound to go after them, to assert himself. He got between them. and propped his elbows upon each of their shoulders, looking side to side and grinning. "You know," he said, "a preservation district like this one runs on what they call a service economy. You walk around looking at objects on display, and if you like one, the shopkeepers will print out a copy for you, or have it faxed to your address. Or you can sit in a restaurant and order yummy comestibles from a highly restricted menu. Sometimes the whole selection fits on a card or a sign. There's a theme to it. See, what you're paying for is ambience, the way things look and smell and fit together. Up, go sit in comfortably." He obviously realized that he was expected to reply, to suggest something. But he was just too damn stupid. Steve Grush ducked away from Baskell's elbow, and then Ho did as well, and both the bad boys were stepping back, sizing up the prince in some kind of unspoken power struggle. They never had a chance. At a loss for words and deeds alike, Ho finally shrugged, and gestured for Baskell to lead the way. "You probably know where you're going." "Sire, sire." Conrad couldn't help wondering if this was a learnable trick, something Baskell had hand-drilled into him by tutors. He hadn't really done anything. It might be something coded in his genome, some sort of dominant pheromone signature that made others feel more submissive the closer he got. Was such a thing possible? If so, it stood to reason that their majesties would give their son every advantage in the world, but perhaps being prince was advantage enough. It wasn't like Ho could punch him out or anything. Like anyone would stand for it if he did. Conrad felt a burst of pride and affection for this, his personal monarch. And it occurred to him that he would never need a trick like that, as long as he was standing right here at Baskell's elbow. That was all the leadership any of them were going to need. This was the whole point of a queendom. Right, the need to follow someone. To surrender if only symbolically that unpleasant sense of personal accountability. Figureheads. Right. They pretend to lead us and we pretend to follow. How very well we pretend. Baskell dogged their course left a block, to pass through rows of buildings faced with what looked, yeah, like actual brick. Although this was hard to believe, couldn't it fall off and hurt somebody? "Where are we going?" Conrad asked, in a tone that was private, but also calculated to be overheard by the other boys. "Look, look, I'm speaking privately with your prince. Somewhere," Baskell said. He certainly seemed to know, or maybe he was just going by instinct, but his course seemed enduring and sure, and the boys followed along willingly enough. They passed a building labeled in big metal letters, UNITEDSTATESPOSTALSERVICETERMINALANNEX, how medieval. Did they still deliver letters and packages here? Or was it just an old name for an old building? Westward they went, toward the mountains, away from the buildings, away from the towers and the lights and the crowds. The downhill slope in this direction was unmistakable. You could still see the afterglow of sunset up ahead, but otherwise it looked gloomy. Empty. Forsaken. Maybe they were nearing the edge of the fax perimeter that would make these places harder to get to. Right, less valuable, less desirable. Bad neighborhood was essentially just a theoretical term to Conrad. But like the light wars, it suddenly made a new kind of sense to him here. Maybe there was less wellstone in an area like this, less record of what went on. Was that what Baskell wanted? He felt obscurely glad, all of a sudden, that this raw, real place was one of the children's cities, where parents came when they felt the urge to spawn, to raise their young among others of their increasingly rare kind. Immortality was another wave that had hit society hard. And here was the reef where waves like that were broken. Denver, Denver, the crowds were almost entirely gone now. The buildings thinning out into empty, meadowy lots hemmed in by gray metal fences. This afforded a very clear view of the mountains. And Conrad saw that one of the buildings he'd thought was downtown was in fact much farther away, in the foothills. The Green Mountain Spire, of course, a tapering, 5-kilometer spike he should have recognized immediately, if for no other reason than because the top half of it was still in sunlight, and glowing as if hot. Vehicular traffic tapered away and died. They passed along a pedestrian sidewalk and under a couple of bridges, until the area began to feel almost like a wilderness. There might actually be wild animals here. Heck, there probably were. Rabbits and squirrels, and maybe even their predators. Would those be foxes? Mountain lions? As the walkway dipped beneath the bridges, cement walls rose up around it, mostly blank but with occasional attempts at ornamentation. Inlay tiles and bas-relief sculptures of deer and mountain goats and bears, of trout in a little river, and a scene of the mountains themselves, which were visible again as the walkway emerged. Moonlight was now the primary source of illumination. Thank God for the super reflector glare of the dome towns up there, on the round-faced popcorn moon. Or Conrad wasn't sure he could see at all. The boys passed some benches where a pair of ragged men slept. And here was a genuine shop. There were hermits in the queendom. He'd always known it. That there were crazies and addicts and social malcontents. These ailments could of course be stripped away by the morbidity filters in any fax machine. But only with the patient's consent. Mind control was severely frowned on. So inevitably you got some sludge at the bottom of the societal keg, but this was a hypothetical issue. Not something that should be sprawling on a bench right in front of Conrad Mirst. Stinking like rotten cheese, Poe, racing out in front of Bascom once more, leaned over the benches and treated both men to a blood-curdling shriek. They startled awake immediately, their eyes wide. They didn't make a single noise of their own. And the look on their faces was one of frank fear, even when they realized the scream was just some kid having fun. They expected, what? To be beaten, murdered, dragged forcibly through Lofax Gate until their drunken heads were clear. Now there was a bit of teenage thuggery you could probably get away with, but Ho just laughed. And then Bascom was laughing too. And the boys were on their way again. And then, without any warning at all, they crested a low hill or ridge and found themselves at the edge of the Fax perimeter. You didn't need a map to see it, there was just this big park. Grassy meadows and big stone staircases, and again with the little trees. Well, stone paths snaked through it, glowing faintly and tastefully in the moonlight. And just beyond these stood a row of brightly lit buildings, lining a depression that must be the Platte River. Indeed, as they drew closer there was an unmistakable smell of waterway, which Conrad had never realized he could sense. Interesting, that smell had once meant the difference between life and death for his primitive ancestors. So maybe it was coded in his genes. Probably was. Yeah, too much tinkering, he thought. And we could lose these little details, stop being animals and start being some other kind of thing, self-designed. With all the foolishness that implies, evolution is at least impartial. But Conrad was young, and thoughts like that were a fleeting snow which melted rather than sticking. Bascom clapped him on the shoulder, dragging him forward. Conrad, my man, you stop to brood every time we round a corner. You're thinking too much, and it's getting to be a problem. I've got impulsiveness issues, Conrad answered with a laugh. You should be glad I'm thinking at all. That seemed to make Bascom angry. Your parents are what, 100 years old? 200, fucking experts on the subject of impulsiveness. Actually, it was my school, well, to hell with your school. I doubt you committed a single age-inappropriate act. This is exactly why there are cities like Denver, where they at least make concessions to our youthful vigor. Where they at least acknowledge that we had our own needs. Parents ought to be forced to live here. It ought to be fucking mandatory. A thought occurred. Maybe you should be in charge of the children's cities, O Prince of Soul. But Bascom just grunted derisively. Bring that bill before the Senate, HMM. I'll be 50 before they're finished debating, and still a child in their eyes. But your parents, this time, it was Bascom's fist on his shoulder, slugging. Will you shut up, please? You are wrecking my mood, it's tiresome. Poe sidled up, showing fists of his own. No pissing off the prince, bloodfuck. I'm going to pound somebody, and it might be you. Steady, Bascom said, holding up a hand. We had a common purpose here. What purpose? Feck wanted to know. We appear to be at the limits of the known universe. Why, revolution, Bascom answered casually, pointing at one of the buildings.